Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has carried out large-scale missile and drone strikes against Israel, targeting the regime's positions deep inside the occupied territories. In one of the operations, Hezbollah targeted the Haifa naval base with a barrage of missiles. Several other Israeli bases, including Mishar, Shuraga and Doviv, were hit as well. The group also destroyed at least six Israeli Merkava tanks in various fronts, including the Deir Mimas and Bayada. Separately, the resistance movement carried out attacks on nearly a dozen of Israeli settlements, including Yiron, Kfar Blum and Sasa. Several gatherings of Israeli forces were also targeted. Hezbollah fired hundreds of rockets on targets across the northern occupied territories, including Tel Aviv, on Sunday. The attacks forced millions of Israeli settlers to hide in bunkers. Israeli media have described the attacks as unprecedented since last month. A fresh wave of Israeli airstrikes has hit southern suburbs of the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Massive consecutive blasts sent thick columns of smoke into the sky minutes after the Israeli army issued evacuation orders for at least 10 buildings south of the city. Earlier, Israel launched two strikes targeting Beirut's Kfar'at area. The number of casualties remains unclear. Meanwhile, the death toll from Saturday's attack on Beirut's central Basta district has risen to 29. In a separate strike, a Lebanese army soldier was killed at a military center in the southern town of Al-Amiriya. Since October last year, Israeli attacks on Lebanon have claimed over 3,750 civilian lives and left more than 15,600 others injured. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saleh joined us earlier with a recap on the Israeli aggression against Lebanon and Hezbollah's retaliatory operations. Let's take a listen.
The attack targets and destroys a whole building, in addition to damaging the surrounding buildings and the neighborhood. So the damages occur also to the surrounding buildings and not only to the designated building that is planned to be destroyed. We also had, of course, several attacks, especially in South Lebanon, Nabatieh. We also noticed in the last week that there were deliberate attacks on the Lebanese military bases as well as the United Nations Interim Force bases and soldiers in South Lebanon. Especially, we know that one of the bases of the Lebanese army has also been evacuated because of the Israeli continuous attacks on those areas. Of course, the death toll we know from the attack on the capital, Beirut, has reached 25. There are still also rescue efforts and the lifting of the rubble continues. There are still missing people under the rubble as well in that attack. Of course, Hezbollah has maintained seemingly a balance when it comes to retaliation. Whenever the capital Beirut is targeted, Hezbollah directly targets the center of the Israeli regime and targets Tel Aviv specifically. We learned today that, of course, Hezbollah targeted the Ashdod military base for the very first time, which is in Tel Aviv. This is also in addition to the Shuraga and the Bilmakim, also a base which is in Tel Aviv as well, and reaching areas which are some 140 kilometers away from the border. And Hezbollah, of course, has today reached a record. They definitely set a new record of operations today.
Authorities in Gaza say the Israeli military has been deliberately targeting the healthcare system in a planned and systematic manner in its ongoing aggression against the blockaded territory. The government media office in Gaza said the regime has killed over 1,000 medical staff, arrested hundreds of them, and subjected them to torture and execution in prisons. It added that the regime has also prevented the entry of medical supplies, health delegations and hundreds of surgeons into Gaza to treat the injured people. The office said it holds Israel, the US and their allies fully responsible for the legal, moral and historical consequences of systematic crimes committed against the Palestinians. It also demanded the international community to exert pressure on Israel to stop what it called the continuous and organized crimes. For over a year, relentless Israeli bombardments have reduced Gaza's shelters, schools and hospitals to rubble, leaving civilians in unimaginable hardship. Children in particular suffer the most, struggling to survive without food, medicine or warm clothing. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel has failed to achieve any of its goals in the Gaza Strip. On day 415 of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, Sami Abu Zuhri, Hamas's senior spokesman, said stopping the genocide is priority of Hamas. He added that, however, the resistance will never accept any agreement that does not lead to a complete end to the suffering of Palestinians and the return to their homes. Zuhri said the resistance will continue until the liberation of Palestine. He said preventing aid from entering Gaza is a war crime, calling on the free people of the world to continue with their protests against the Israeli regime. Israeli forces press ahead with their violent raids on Palestinian cities and towns across the occupied West Bank. Recently, the city of Jenin and its refugee camp have been the focal point of the regime's incursions. Israeli forces have killed two young Palestinians in a town southwest of Jenin. November 25 marks the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, but in Palestine, this day underscores the suffering of women subjected to violations under Israeli occupation. From physical assault to imprisonment, Palestinian women face daily injustices. Nicole Hamad has more.
As of 2023, over 400 Palestinian women have been detained in Israeli prisons amid reports of mistreatment, torture, food deprivation, and sexual harassment. As the world marks November 25th, the International Day Against Gender-Based Violence, Palestinian women feel betrayed by the silence of international women's organizations and institutions.
The occupation targets Palestinian women because they are central to life and resistance. For decades, women have stood at the forefront, enduring torture, deprivation, and harassment. Their resilience threatens the occupation, which seeks to erase them. Today, this violence escalates, with women facing killings, imprisonment, exploitation, and abuse in both Gaza and the West Bank.
And for the international women's organizations, Palestinian women are horrified by their silence.
The Israeli genocide against our people reveals the moral and humanitarian failure of these systems. We must challenge this false narrative on human rights.
As for Asma Ahrish, she never forgot stories she left behind in Israeli prison.
Detention is violence, and administrative detention is imprisonment without charge. During my time in detention, I witnessed physical and verbal abuse, violent nighttime raids, beatings, insults, starvation policies, and medical neglect that worsened health conditions among female prisoners. We wondered, where are the women and human rights organizations? Where is the world amid these violations?
A question that remains unanswered. Palestinian women are the backbone of their communities, yet they face unabating violations under Israeli occupation. As the world marks this day in a year of relentless genocide, it's time to amplify their voices and demand an end to the violence they endure every day. Naqa Hamad, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has called for action in defense of Palestinian women and girls as the world marks the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. Ismail Baghaei issued the call in a post on his ex social media account. He said the international occasion is a reminder of the extreme Israeli violence Palestinian women and girls have been facing for decades. Baghaei described as unprecedented the violence waged against female Palestinians in Gaza, where tens of thousands of women and girls have been brutally killed and maimed. He added that starvation and repeated forced displacement are other miseries mothers and girls have been grappling with in Gaza since October last year. Iran's embassy in the UAE has categorically rejected allegations that the Islamic Republic was involved in the killing of an Israeli rabbi and former soldier in the Arab country. The rejection comes as some Western and Israeli media accuse Iran of involvement in the killing of Zavi Kogan, who was found dead after he went missing in the UAE on Thursday. The UAE's Interior Ministry confirms that three people have been arrested in connection with the murder. According to the Israeli outlet Ynet, Kogan had previously served in the Israeli Army's Givati Brigade, whose members have been carrying out deadly military operations in the Gaza Strip since October 7th last year. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has carried out new anti-Israel operations, striking two targets deep inside the occupied territories. The umbrella group of Iraqi resistance factions said the fierce operation involving drones struck a military target in the south of the occupied territories. The group said the second operation hit a vital Israeli position, also in the south of the occupied land. The Iraqi resistance says its operations are in support of the oppressed Palestinian and Lebanese people who are being slaughtered by the Israeli regime. The group has also targeted American military bases in Iraq and Syria over Washington's support for Israel and its genocidal war in Gaza. The Islamic resistance in Iraq has vowed to press ahead with its operations with increasing intensity. A gunman was killed and three security officers were injured in a shooting incident near the Israeli embassy in the Jordanian capital. Press TV's Zayed Kaba reports from Amman.
Early on Sunday, Jordanians woke up to a shooting near the Israeli embassy in Amman. According to an official government statement, the shooter exchanged fire with security forces, injuring three officers. He was subsequently killed. Political analysts have linked the incident to the significance of the location, which has been the site of year-long protests involving thousands of Jordanians calling on the Jordanian government to close the Israeli embassy.
What happened this morning is an unacceptable attack in every sense. We oppose it politically, and we assert that the presence of this embassy, if the incident was indeed related to it, does not justify the assault on the public security forces. These officers are our sons, and they represent the decisions made by political forces, the government, and parliament. As the Popular Unity Party, as political figures, and as political parties, we view the public security forces as the Jordanian forces. They must not be challenged or confronted. The international community and global organizations must exert pressure on Israel to halt its genocidal war.
Jordan's leftist parties attributed the incident to escalating tensions over events in Gaza and called for urgent regional and international action to end the war.
I believe that what occurred today in front of the Israeli embassy in Amman cannot be viewed in isolation from the criminal war. Israel is waging against the people in Gaza and Lebanon. This Zionist entity is conducting a campaign of genocide. The emotional, political, and future repercussions of this genocide are felt across all Arab and Muslim nations, as well as by all free people around the world.
It's important to note that the Israeli embassy in Amman has been closed for over a year after the start of Israel's war on Gaza in early October last year. This led to Jordan recalling its ambassador from Israel and not allowing the return of Israel's ambassador, who had previously left the kingdom. As these developments unfold, calls are growing to bring an end to the genocidal war on Gaza and to ensure regional stability. Jordanians are highlighting the importance of taking decisive action to support the Palestinian cause and work towards a just peace. Zayed Agarbe, Amman.
In our explainer program, we delved into the recent decision by the outgoing U.S. President Joe Biden to supply Ukraine with attacker missiles. These missiles can reach deep into Russian territory. The move has escalated the conflict significantly. Russia has responded strongly, revising its nuclear doctrine and targeting Ukraine with hypersonic ballistic missiles. Let's take a listen to Kaveh Taghvayi, who broke down the implications of these developments for us.
Well, the U.S. and the U.K. have taken the Russia's special military operation in Ukraine to another level, threatening not only the U.K. but also the whole of Europe. The U.S. President Joe Biden's decision to provide Ukraine with ATACM missile systems, along with U.K.'s decision to provide Storm Shadow missiles, both capable of reaching inside of Russia, has changed the rules of the conflict, especially from the Russian side. First, on the U.S. missiles, they are called the ATACM. Many of these are tactical missile systems within that category, short-range ballistic missiles that can strike targets 300 kilometers or 190 miles away with a warhead containing about 375 pounds of explosives. Ukraine fired six ATACMs in total at the Bryansk region. Then comes UK's Storm Shadows missiles. Now, this has a range in excess of 250 kilometers or 155 miles and is launched from an aircraft. And then it flies at close to the speed of sound before dropping down and detonating its high-explosive warhead. Now, it's an ideal weapon for penetrating hardened bunkers and ammunition stores. Ukraine fired 12 of these missiles into the Kursk region, targeting the same. When it comes to Ukraine's missile reach into Russia, in terms of that, there are two categories, actually. One's called the Russian military objects. These will be things like bunkers and weapons depots. The other, Russian air military bases, which there are a number of them, particularly the ones, obviously, that are within the reach, closer than the ones deep inside of Russia. The reach, 300 kilometers or 190 miles. And there's 225 military objects and 14 Russian military air bases within this range. The attack, as Russia stated, changed the rules of the game, and quickly. First, on the same day of the attack, Russia's President Vladimir Putin updated Russia's nuclear doctrine. Moscow now considered aggression from any non-nuclear state, but with the participation of a nuclear country, a joint attack on Russia. In essence, Russia is saying that the revised military doctrine would lower the bar to the use of nuclear weapons. Then came Russia's retaliation or counterattack. Now, Russia deployed what's called the new Oreshnik missile. It's a ballistic missile, hypersonic one, a new development based on cutting-edge hypersonic technology, flying at a speed of up to 10 Mach, which is around 7,600 miles, or 12,200 kilometers per hour, which is roughly 10 times the speed of sound, making it extremely difficult to intercept using current missile defense systems. Now, Russia struck a Ukrainian defense facility in an area by the name of Dnepropetrovsk. The target was Yuzhmash, one of Ukraine's largest defense industrial facilities, with the missile striking it, inherited from the USSR, that produced missile equipment and other weapons. Russia stated, wanted to make a point that this Oreshnik missile system cannot be intercepted, that there was no military system capable of doing that, which is why this ballistic missile system has global impact and strategic significance, since it can hit targets throughout Europe that you see there. With the State of Times, these are some of the potential targets, including the UK, that Russia says is now in the war. That it would take for this missile to reach the UK is within minutes. This can have wider geopolitical implications if tensions escalate further, which should put other European countries in check.
And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Zionist Hasbara, bolstered by a powerful media plutocracy and influential special interest groups in the West, has normalized Israeli regime lies and bias against Palestinians for over 76 years. This media-constructed narrative distorts public understanding, manipulates public discourse, and shapes policy debates. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The systematic dissemination of misinformation positioned Western media as a key instrument in manufacturing consent for the Zionist regime's wars of genocide. A UN special committee has characterized Israel's war in Gaza as genocide, while Western free media has abandoned its ethical responsibility to cover and or report objectively on the conduct of Israel's wars in Gaza and Lebanon. Western corporate media outlets, without exception, acquiesce to Israeli directives barring reporters from entering Gaza. Journalists embedded with the Zionist regime army report only what Israel permits them to observe, creating one-sided, heavily filtered narrative. The programmed absence has deprived Western public of critical information to show that UNICEF describes as the most dangerous place in the world for children. Disregarding these realities, corporate Western media outlets often dehumanize Palestinians, dismissing their grievance while overtly empathizing with the Israelis. Case in point, they extensively cover the relocation of hundreds of Israeli regime families, while offering little to no coverage on the scholasticide of 625,000 Palestinian children who are unable to attend school for a second year because the Zionist regime has damaged or destroyed 85% of Gaza's schools. Similarly, they disregard UN documented Israel's use of starvation as a weapon of war, destroying vital water, sanitation and food systems, and neglect the plight of 90% of Gaza's internally displaced population, many of whom have been forced to relocate 9 or 10 times. In addition, the media's intentional omission of the destruction of the entire higher education system, with 100% of Gaza's 12 universities demolished, leaving 88,000 students unable to continue their studies. Just as with the systematic destruction of Gaza's educational system, the free media has failed to critically report on the Zionist regime's deliberate strategy to dismantle Gaza's healthcare system. According to former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, this strategy involved relentless and intentional attacks on medical personnel and facilities, including the killing, detention, and torture of medical staff as part of a concerted policy to destroy Gaza's healthcare system. By the end of July 2024, the World Health Organization reported that the Zionist regime had conducted 498 raids on healthcare facilities. Out of Gaza's 36 hospitals, less than 16 are partially operational, leading to the near total collapse of the healthcare system. The managed free media deploys countless reporters in Tel Aviv to cover the effectiveness of Israel's Iron Dome missile system, yet no one on the ground investigates the starvation in northern Gaza or even show the face of one of the approximately 16,800 murdered children or the anguish of over 17,000 children who have lost one or both parents. At the same time, the programmed media floods the screens with images of a broken glass window with a Jewish-only colony, but no camera are allowed to capture the devastated 163,778-plus residential units in Gaza. The so-called free Western media does not question or fact-check Israeli disinformation. Haspara, when American-made jets targeted schools or demolished residential towers under the pretext of command centers inside these facilities. Worse yet, the media propagates a false narrative, portraying Israel's malevolent policies as acts of benevolence because they issue a warning ahead of bombing homes to smithereens and then murder civilians as they evacuate under the same orders. Journalists ignore Palestinian voices pointing out that the wide-scale destruction of homes, safe shelters, and critical infrastructure is part of a calculated Israeli strategy to render Gaza uninhabitable and forcibly displace its residents. Their reporting from afar normalizes Israeli violence and ethnic cleansing as they parrot Israeli Newspeak without the scrutiny. A glaring example of the media abdicating its objectivity is the case of Ashrafa Hospital. Their Israeli regime military officials showcased an elaborate 3D model purportedly depicting a command center beneath the hospital. The Israeli disinformation was echoed by U.S. President Joe Biden and the White House, further amplifying the false Israeli narratives to an unsuspected public. In November 2023, Ashrafa Hospital was occupied by the Israeli regime army. Doctors were kidnapped, several tortured to death in Israeli regime custody, and the hospital was forced out of service. Western journalists, embedded with the Israeli regime military, joined the Israeli army to show the world what was claimed to be a military command center beneath the hospital. However, to uncover that the only underground edifices in the hospital's vast complex were originally designed in Israeli architects Gershon Zippor and Benjamin Idelson and commissioned by the occupying Israeli Public Works Department in 1983. The embedded Israeli propaganda tool, as known as Western Media, accompanied Israel's chief disinformation officer on a tour of Ashrafa Hospital, but left empty-handed, unable to find the flaunted command control center or any military facilities under the hospital. Human Rights Watch later concluded that the military raid at the hospital constituted a war crime after failing to provide evidence to justify revoking the hospital's status as protected by the laws of war. Rather than holding the Zionist regime accountable for destroying a major health facility, the embedded media continued to market Israeli lies to excuse violations of international law. The lack of critical reporting and fact-checking is a betrayal of the journalistic responsibilities, effectively serving as implicit approval or, at the very least, normalization of the Israeli war crimes. Another case on how the media facilitates violence and aggression is the adoption of Israeli nuanced jargons that desensitizes readers and redirects focus. For instance, by framing Israel's war against Palestinians in Gaza and the people of Lebanon as a war against Hamas or Hezbollah, the media employs euphemisms that deflect Israeli responsibility for the broader impact of the war on innocent civilians. This framing whitewashes Israeli culpability for the destruction of 80% of homes, 60% of the hospitals, 85% of the schools, 100% of the universities, and the displacement of 90% of the population, the razing of villages and the starvation of children, portraying these atrocities as mere collateral damage or unintended victims in a crossfire. Furthermore, Western media's dereliction in contextualizing Israeli violations of the international humanitarian law, the findings of the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court, leaves readers unaware of the legal ramifications and obscures accountability. In doing so, Western media becomes, wittingly or unwittingly, a complicit platform in Israeli regime Hasbara. Western media has even abandoned fellow local journalists who remained in Gaza and were purposely targeted by the Zionist regime army. Israel's assault on the truth, including attacks on journalists and their families, is unprecedented in war zones.
This is A to Z. An Introduction into an Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, the negative effects of backbiting and listening to backbiting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab. So today I'm talking to you about the negative effects of backbiting. And what I'm concerned with today in particular is the issue that not only are the people who are backbiting, but we also have the people who are typically listening to the backbiter. Because obviously a person, it's very difficult for a person to backbite unless that person has an audience of at least one other person or more. Now, the problem is, because you might think, oh, well, you know, the backbite is a bad one. Problem is, as soon as we are in a gathering, in a sense that this sort of sin, it's almost as if it's amplified it. And I'll just mention this one hadith from the Holy Prophet, who said that the listener is one of the two backbiters. And for example, so the punishment, and I'll just tell you this, the punishment, for example, is actually more severe than the punishment of the original backbite. And that is because the whole idea of backbiting being such a grave sin, worse than adultery, is that it, in a sense, undermines this foundation of our Islamic society. It takes away the goodness, the honesty, what we're actually trying to create, what we're trying to build in Islamic society, our Islamic ummah. So, for example, if imagine you're in a gathering. No, it could be anyone. Let's just say someone's talking about a friend. Maybe there's a group of friends together and one person talks about another friend they all know and says that, oh, you know, that person hasn't really been themselves lately. Or it could, and then the other person adds that, oh, yes, I know they failed to, I know that they're not doing their namaz at the moment. Yeah, something like that. They're not praying, they're not doing their salat. So obviously this person, A, has revealed something that should normally be concealed. And also, obviously, they're also now engaging and adding to this backbiting. Welcome back. This is A to Z and RIB English Radio. So I'm just talking to you about the negative effects of the listeners to backbiting. So talking about when a person in gathering of, let's say, some friends says something maybe about someone who's a bit negligent of some of the our practices, maybe not praying, not doing this a lot, and someone else. And then obviously there's other people, the other friends are hearing this. Now, the person who's actually listening to this, who hears this, and it doesn't actually refute it, doesn't say, no, that's not the truth, or just tells that person, no, we can't talk, we can't say this, this is backbiting. They're actually then guilty of the sin of backbiting by 70 times. So it's actually whoever's just listening and not doing something has a burden that's 70 times as big. So, for example, we're told that if we hear backbiting and there's actually benefits and there's reasons because in terms of building this Islamic society in which people's sins, people's flaws are concealed. There's a reason why Allah doesn't want us to backbite, because Allah hides in general our faults from other people. And so obviously if we ourselves choose to reveal the flaws of others, we are committing a sin of the very great magnitude. Now, we are told if we hear backbiting in a gathering from other people, we must refute it. If we do refute it, Allah will save us from 1,000 different kinds of evils in this world and the hereafter. This is according to hadith by Imam al-Sada. Now, and obviously if we choose not to do so, we get the burden of the sin of backbiting ourselves 70 times over. So this is just a very small snippet, in a sense, of what happens when we're listening to backbiting and don't do anything about it. And inshallah, these are just a few thoughts for you. And inshallah, you'll tune in to A to Z on RIB English Radio another time, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The International Criminal Court, the ICC, at The Hague, Netherlands, has issued arrest warrants against the Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former war minister Yoav Gallant. We take a look at how the world media has covered this news story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Large numbers of Iranian demonstrators gathered outside the United Nations office in the capital Tehran to condemn the Israeli regime's war crimes after arrest warrants were issued by the International Criminal Court, the ICC. The ICC's pre-trial chamber 1 issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former War Minister Yoav Gallant for crimes against humanity and war crimes committed from at least 8th of October 2023 until at least 20th of May 2024, the day the prosecution filed the applications for warrants of arrest. It is the first instance in the court's 22-year history it has issued arrest warrants for Western Allied senior officials. Hundreds of protesters on Friday, 22nd of November, called for the United Nations' immediate and firm move to expel the Israeli regime from the world body and other international organizations. The demonstrators in Tehran denounced the Tel Aviv regime's genocide and criminal acts against innocent Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The protesters slammed international bodies, including the United Nations, over their failure to stop Israeli atrocities in the Gaza Strip and also in Lebanon. The Iranian demonstrators shouted slogans such as The child-killing Zionist regime should be expelled from the United Nations and down with Israel. The participants lashed out at the United States and its Western allies for supporting the Israeli regime, including vetoing a Gaza ceasefire resolution, saying the UN Security Council structure lacks the efficiency to stop Israel's war crimes in Gaza and in southern Lebanon. The protesters called on United Nations top officials to exert pressure on the Israeli regime to end its crimes in the Gaza Strip and in Lebanon. The demonstrators also waved Iranian and Palestinian flags. The United States on Wednesday, 20th of November, vetoed another draft resolution at the United Nations Security Council calling for an immediate, unconditional and permanent ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. It was the fourth time the administration of President Joe Biden has wielded its veto power to block a ceasefire in Gaza since the Israeli regime launched its genocidal war on the coastal sliver in October of last year. More than 44,000 Palestinians, many of them women and children, have been killed brutally, and over 104,000 people have been wounded in Israel's brutal war in Gaza. The war began on 7th of October last year. The Israeli regime enjoys unreserved military and political support on the part of its Western allies, including the United States and France. The website firstpost.com has also covered the same story and tells us more. The International Criminal Court, the ICC, at The Hague, Netherlands, has issued arrest warrants against Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former war minister Yoav Gallant. Here's a look at which 124 countries can detain them and who has already said that the two leaders will be arrested. All the 124 member states of the Rome Statute are now compelled to detain Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former war minister Yoav Gallant after the International Criminal Court, the ICC, issued arrest warrants against them over war crimes relating to the brutal war in Gaza. Notably, it is the first time that the leaders of a Western-aligned state have been charged by the ICC headquarters at The Hague in Netherlands. The arrest warrants against Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant have been issued in response to accusations of crimes against humanity and war crimes in Israel's brutal war in the Gaza Strip. The ICC said there were reasonable grounds to believe that senior Israeli officials bore criminal responsibility as co-perpetrators for the war crimes of starvation as a method of warfare, and the crimes against humanity of murder, persecution, and other inhumane acts. But how difficult will it get for Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant? It appears that the arrest warrants mean that the world has just shrunk for both Israeli politicians, and they're now expected to restrict their travel to avoid any possible arrests internationally. But can ICC enforce its power on member states? The answer is no. The International Criminal Court does not have enforcement powers. It can just expect cooperation from member states to arrest and surrender suspects. Also, the International Criminal Court at The Hague, Netherlands, was established under a 1998 treaty called the Rome Statute, which includes 124 state parties across six continents of the world. The Rome Statute investigates and, where warranted, tries individuals charged with the gravest crimes of concern to the international community, which includes genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity and the crime of aggression.
Palestinian art.
Art is the title to describe the beauty or a language used to translate its emotions and feelings, resulting in aesthetic values interacting with all the people, despite the different tongues and colors. Palestinian artists have devoted all their intellectual and creative abilities since the Nakba in 1948 to highlight the unique Palestinian narrative. Anxiety, sadness, pain, sacrifice, and struggle are the inspiration for many artists who have adopted the idea of liberating all of Palestine. It is for their narrative to be noticed, above all the conspiracies hatched against them for the insidious purpose of imposing false facts on the ground and on the Palestinian people, in painting a picture that attempts to identify Israel the aggressor as the victim.
Every artwork presents a valuable theme and truth about Palestine in a beautiful and civilized way. I think the Israelis oppose this as they search for any image that they can use to tarnish the Palestinian community and depict Palestinians as terrorists. This is a key goal of Israel because such art portrays a civilized people which the Israeli don't want the world to see.
It is the role of intellectuals to eliminate and carry on our cause, that we are the rightful owners of this land. This land is ours as Palestinians, and those taking it over are intruders and thieves. Their claims to the land are illegitimate.
The shocking volume of acts and crimes committed and still being committed by the Israeli occupation have an enormous and traumatic impact on the minds of Palestinian artists who carry a huge responsibility that urges them toward innovation and creativity and to use all available means to achieve a strength of community capable of resisting the occupation and b the mobilization of resistance and armed resistance.
We saw killings, houses reduced to rubble by missiles, and families displaced and resistors murdered. All those atrocities scar a humane person's spirit. The artist is most capable of representing their internal experiences or debriefing through their artwork.
The art knows no lies. It can complement or beautify the image by bearing its vulnerability and honesty. Art addresses the sensations and conscience of people and is closer and truer to humankind in imitating and touching the concerns of being human.
In the war on Gaza, initiated by the Israeli occupational forces in 2014, flames and smoke caused by constant heavy shelling pervaded the air. It was the idea of a few Palestinian painters to express that sense of smoke into paintings that could reach the citizens of Palestine and the outside world over the internet in a timely fashion.
I used to go up on my roof at home and try to take the perfect photo to see where that photo would take me or what I'd like to portray through it. The first drawing that caught my sight was one of smoke emitting from two sides, which encapsulated a V sign. I formed an outline and posted it to Facebook, where it went viral, receiving many comments and likes.
The smoke drawing went viral because everyone was able to participate and see it. The depiction was linked to Facebook and other social networking communities. It received wide attention and momentum that echoed across the social media world, where it enjoyed large numbers of views in a short space of time. Other attempts posted were unable to capture similar attention, but the smoke drawing attracted massive media attention. Everyone that sees the smoke envisages a destroyed home with dead people and devastated lives in its place. However, I try to bring this place back to life in my own way, where I can change the image of destruction into an image that's more at ease to the sensitivities of people. There are two bombings depicted in the image, so I thought to change the image to that of a slingshot and at the same time transcend the smoke to a stone held within the slingshot that we want to cast back at you.
I selected this photo. It looks like a giant emerging from between the houses. It looks like an aching man or a giant. I have been trying recently to highlight the features that I want to work on and how I see it. We talk about the cruelty of war and the violence of the Israeli occupation on our people and over our land. Some artists produce artwork pertaining to war. Maybe that's what has increased the focus of how people are capable of thinking and creating under such subjugating conditions, which poses the questions that incite this greater attention.
Each painting of the smoke theme, and it's a unique meaning. This was reflected in the transformation of death from the flames and smoke to life. The paintings probably bothered the Israeli occupation, which always sought to close any window of hope opened by the Palestinians under subjugation.
This type of drawing is like a double-edged sword. The first edge honors Palestinian people's patience and steadfastness. We are a life-loving people and that nothing can destroy our will. The second edge comes from the world community's view that there is only war here and it's unlikely that we do anything differently. But we create a life, even within the imposing upon us of death and war and blood.
The art used to antagonize the Israeli occupiers, irrespective of any other trends attempting to dominate, it remains a first-class resistance art movement.
The rapid spread of smoke drawings of dozens of artists from Gaza and the West Bank during the war attracted the interest of several international institutions, which invited selected artists to display their paintings at international exhibitions.
If the plastic art has no ability to communicate directly with the world due to the choking occupation and siege, then they would communicate through subcultures via a variety of mediums that reach other countries and show the way we live and that we also have art. Our life and expression is not different in that way from the lives of other peoples.
After the success of my drawing posted on Facebook, I received several invitations, including one from America, inviting me to attend an event and talk about my drawings. I couldn't travel, but sent five drawings of my own creation. The Gaza war was the key theme of the exhibition.
I attended an international event in Morocco for 13 days after the war on Gaza, where I presented my drawing, which was inspired by the words of Mohammed Darwish, in which he said, She lives broken for being nothing but the dove of peace. They said there is no peace. The canvas was 1 square meter, on which I drew for an audience of 30 artists from different countries. In addition, School Smoke, one of the drawings of Manal, awarded her an invitation to the Moroccan conference.
The national song or anthem played a significant role in mobilizing citizens, especially those who had lost their families and or homes, and for those displaced during the war. The meaning within the lyrics comforted those afflicted in their plight. After the Gaza war came to an end, people came out from their sheltered hiding places to witness the aftermath and lament at the sight of dust and rubble, which used to be their neighborhood. Iyad Sabah wanders among the desolate streets empty of people. The extent of the destruction is seared in his mind, and ideas of how to express what he was seeing as art churned inside his head.
When we went to Al-Shajaya after the war ended, the aftermath was horrifying, an unbelievable scale of destruction. It looked like an abstract work as you witnessed the twisted destruction of what was once normal life, like you were doing something abnormal, from which the idea stemmed as to how to use the debris to re-establish the original scene, but in a contemporary plastic way through work in the public space, which is the combined action that's our theme.
Iyad Sabah's thoughts eventually transposed into an artwork that revived the memory of the devastated Al-Shajaiya area. 3 sculptures expressing a family displaced by the conflict were erected as a memorial.
This entire family is part of the notion of displacement that I wanted to personify through the different segments of the Palestinian community. We see through an exterior cover, making us sense that it is whole and strong. But when we look closer, we notice that the work is made of fragile material, such as clay, that cracks and falls. Those cracks resemble the wounds made of essential fiber colored with red. We were surrounded by people of the area as we began combining the statues. It's just typically them. They said that's how they left their homes. They were linking the statues to some people they knew. They felt the heat of the crisis again. And at the same time, they felt that someone out there feels for them.
Iyad Sabah's idea made its way to afflicted Palestinians and to the world outside Gaza, causing foreign states to offer to host an art exhibition on his behalf, so that his sculptures, which entailed an authentic expression of the catastrophe, could be displayed. This is Palestinian art. Based on real life, it reflects the helplessness of a people imprisoned under occupation by an apartheid regime seemingly above international law. The artists' expressions communicate the truth of their suffering, and it's a message to the world that Palestinians seek not to be terrorized and their children traumatized, but to have basic rights and to be free from occupation.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.